This is Jonah chapter 2. If you remember, we looked last week at the storm that had come into Jonah's life. And we talked about how that sometimes the storm is really God's blessing in our life to do the painful thing of exposing our sin. And I used that dental illustration last week, which seemed to have gone a long way with people. Everybody was commenting about how painful it was every time they thought about going to the dentist. But the truth is that the dentist is a good thing. And going to get your teeth drilled, as painful as it may be, is a good thing because it exposes the decay and it allows God, it allows the dentist to do what needs to be done. And so this is the situation that Jonah finds himself in. He has run away from God in the beginning of chapter 1. He has been exposed as a prophet who has run away from God at the end of chapter 1. And Jonah, at the end of chapter 1, is thrown into the sea, where a great fish comes and swallows him whole. Now, the language of that last verse in Jonah chapter 1 is actually fairly interesting because it talked about a great fish. And if you look to chapter 1, there's all sorts of great, that word great is used a great deal throughout chapter 1. For example, in the beginning, God wants Jonah to preach to the great city of Nineveh. And then when Jonah rebels against God, God sends a great wind to the sea. And then it causes a great storm. And then the sailors greatly tremble before God. And finally, God sends a great fish. And all of it is to remind us that there is a great God in control of the affairs of our lives, and he will direct them as he wills. And so the fish and the storm and all that goes about it is a part of God's direction in Jonah's life. Now, Jonah chapter 2 really becomes a little bit different than the rest of the book. The rest of the book is sort of a narrative in that it's telling a story and there's dialogue and there's things that go back and forth. But Jonah chapter 2 really is a song or a psalm. In fact, a lot of the language that is used in this psalm would give us indication that Jonah was familiar with the Psalms of David and the Psalms of Solomon in the Old Testament because it has a similar sort of ring to it, and he uses similar words and things like that. But I got to confess that it always kind of bothered me that that the book changed to poetry this soon in the process. You know, I like to hear a good story, and I'm not so much sure I like to hear a good poem, but I like to hear a good story. And so I always wondered, and evidently scholars have wondered too, if Jonah chapter 2 isn't a little bit out of place in the context of the whole book. But then, if you really start to break the book down and look at the four chapters of Jonah, this is very interesting. Jonah chapter 1 begins with this: the word of the Lord comes to Jonah. Jonah chapter 2 begins basically with the verse that say, Jonah prayed. Jonah chapter 3 begins with the word of the Lord came again to Jonah. And Jonah chapter 4, verse 2, begins with the words, and Jonah prayed to God. So you see, there's really a dialogue that's going on in the entire book. God speaks in chapter 1, Jonah speaks in chapter 2. God speaks in chapter 3, Jonah speaks in chapter 4. Now, the prayer in chapter 4 is a different kind of prayer. It's more conversational. And Jonah chapter 2 is more of a prayer of adoration and of praise and directing glory to God directly. So, but nevertheless, you see the contrasting things between God speaking and Jonah speaking. So we're going to take a little time this morning and look at this prayer that Jonah prays in the belly of the great fish. And the first thing that we know about is that Jonah calls out to the Lord in his distress. He calls out to the Lord in his distress. It says in verse 2, he said, in my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. Now, it may be worth noting that this is the first time in the story of Jonah that Jonah prays. He doesn't pray in chapter 1 when he's running away from God, and he doesn't want to go to Nineveh. He doesn't pray there. At least we don't see him praying. He doesn't pray when the storm comes over the boat and the sailors are petrified that their lives are going to be taken and their property is going to be destroyed. And they're praying. The sailors are praying like crazy. But Jonah is not praying. When the sailors come to him and say, "What should we do? How do we make the storm stop?" Jonah doesn't pray there. Jonah doesn't pray to God and seek God's direction. He simply says, "Throw me overboard and the storm will stop." Jonah only prays when he gets into the belly of the fish in the time of his great distress, when he's thrown overboard and then the fish comes along and swallows him whole. I was preaching on Jonah a number of years ago at Hunt Valley. This is a good while ago. And I had remembered reading a story of a man who had jumped into the Niagara River to commit suicide. You know, he was going to go over Niagara Falls. But he lived. And one of the few people that have actually done, there are a handful of people that have gone over the falls and lived, but most people don't. He said he was a little bit depressed, and I would say, yeah, you probably would be a little bit depressed to jump in the falls. But they ask him afterwards, "What were you thinking, you know, as you're floating down the river about to go over the falls?" And he said, "I was thinking this was a really bad idea." In other words, on the bank, he was thinking life isn't worth living. But when he threw himself into the water and he's inches away from the falls, he's thinking, you know, life may be worth living after all. And that's kind of where Jonah is. You know, in the boat, he's saying, "Throw me overboard, life isn't worth living." But then he actually gets thrown overboard and he starts to sink to the bottom of the depths of the sea, and the seaweed starts to wrap around his neck. And then all of a sudden he's thinking, you know, this probably wasn't a good idea. Life may be worth living after all. So in the midst of that, he calls out in his distress, he says, and God hears him. Now, if you think about a person in distress, you think the distress sort of denotes an emotional kind of instability, right? If you're in distress, you know, you can't eat, you can't sleep, you can't think right, you can't do your work, you can't talk to people normally. I mean, everything is sort of discombobulated emotionally. And what is the source of this distress that Jonah feels? What is the source of this problem? Think about it. Who is the cause of all of Jonah's distress? Isn't it his own fault? Isn't it his own foolishness? I mean, sometimes you're in distress, you know, because you lose your job. You know, it's not your fault you lost your job. Or sometimes you're in distress because, you know, someone close to you dies, and it's not your fault that they died. But sometimes you're in distress because you did something really foolish or really stupid. Or really something that you say, you know, I wish now that I'm floating down this river, I wish I wouldn't have done that. And that's Jonah's situation. His distress is caused by his own rebellion against God, by his own sin, by his own desire to run away from God. And yet, here's the thing with God. God doesn't say, "Jonah, it's your own fault. You get your act together, you get your priorities right, and then maybe I'll listen to what you have to say. Maybe then I'll consider your prayer." But God doesn't say that. Jonah is in a distress of his own making, and he calls out to God, and God doesn't put any conditions on the answer to the prayer. God just listens, and he hears what Jonah has to say. And he says, "I will answer the prayer of this distressed person, regardless of the cause of his distress." Well, Jonah calls out in the midst of his distress, but he also calls out, according to the language of the text, from the grave. Did you notice that in the second part of verse 2? "From the depths of the grave, I called to you." Now, depending what translation you have this morning, it might not say grave. It might say hell, or it might say death. Or it might use the actual Hebrew word, which is Sheol. Sheol was considered to be the place of the dead. And it's used a great deal in Old Testament literature, particularly in the poetic literature, about talking about the place where you go when you die. Where do you go? You go to Sheol. Now, the King James version of the Bible translated that word into hell. So, but that concept, that Old Testament concept of Sheol, isn't exactly the same as our concept of hell. We think of hell as the place of the damned and of the judged. But Sheol is the place of everybody. Everybody who dies, their body is put into the grave and they are put into death. And so Jonah sees his situation, not only the emotional distress and the spiritual distress that he's going through, but he sees the physical distress that he's going through, and he's saying, I am as close to death, or I was as close to death as I could possibly be. In fact, the whole psalm is really flavored with this allusions to the grave or to death. For example, look in verse 4. I said, I have been banished from your sight. That's where Sheol, you were banished from God's sight in their thinking, yet I will look again towards your holy temple. So he could be thinking a couple of different things, but one of them is, you know, I was definitely going to die, but now I know I'm going to live. Now I'm going to look towards Jerusalem. I'm going to be able to look towards the temple. Or look in verse 5. He says, to the engulfing waters threatened me, the deep surround me. Well, what did they threaten? Well, they threatened his life. They threatened his very existence on this earth. Or look at verse 6. This language is really powerful. It said, the roots of the mountain I sank, to the roots of the mountain I sank down. The earth beneath barred me in forever. Now that language of being barred in, Sheol was a place that the Old Testament people thought had bars on it. And they thought it was a place that once, and you can understand why, because once you got there, you didn't come back. Nobody knew anybody that ever came back from the dead. So death must have bars on it. It must have a gate on it. And remember, Jesus borrows this language, doesn't he? He says, I will build my church, and the gates of hell, or the gates of Sheol, will not prevail against it. In other words, you know, Jesus is going to break the bars of death itself. So even here, the language is this language of death. Jonah says, it isn't that I'm just emotionally and spiritually distressed. I am close to physical death. Now, the language is so strong that some commentators have suggested that Jonah really did die. But I don't think that's necessary to make the point. Jonah may simply be saying, look, I was as close to death as anybody can get. I was in the water, the seaweed wrapped around my neck. I figured I would never see the Jerusalem again. I figured I was about to enter the deepest part of the sea, and Sheol was in the deepest part of the earth, and I figured the bars were closing in. But you saved me. You listened to me. You heard my cry. Now, what's the point here? What does Jonah discover in the midst of this experience? Well, he discovers maybe more, but two things, and one is he discovers that God is there in the midst of our distress, and even when we come close to death. In fact, he discovers what the psalmist wrote about in Psalm 139, verse 8, if I go to the heavens, you are there. Everybody understands that. But if I make my bed in the depths, you are there. Or if I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. So even though Jonah is as far deep in the earth in his mind as you can possibly get. And by the way, the deepest valleys in the mountain, in the sea, you know, do you realize this, are higher than some of the highest mountains on top of the earth? In other words, the sea is as deep as Mount Everest. You could take Mount Everest in some of the valleys in the ocean and turn it upside down. You wouldn't see it. And so Jonah said, I am as far away from God spiritually, emotionally, and physically as I could possibly be on this earth. And yet, God is there. I can't escape him. I can't run away from him. And in this particular case, that's a good thing. And here's the second thing he learns. He learns that God hears my prayer regardless of the circumstances, regardless of who's at fault, regardless of whether it's my fault, somebody else's fault, regardless of whether I put myself into this situation or not. God is not only there, but he hears what I have to say. Now that's a powerful lesson. Because all of us, at certain times in our lives, will feel in distress, and we will feel as if we are as close to death, as far from God as we could possibly be. But God is never far away. and God will always hear the cries of his people. So Jonah calls out to the Lord. That's the first thing we're looking at here. Here's the second thing we're going to look at. Jonah sees God's deliverance. In other words, it isn't just I'm in distress and things are bad. The psalm is actually filled with a great deal of hope. Now, I've often wondered about this, because if I was Jonah and I'm swallowed up by a big, great big fish, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to die in the fish, right? Or if I don't die in the ocean, I'll die in the fish. But Jonah is praying this prayer. He's not praying it in the ocean. He's praying it in the belly of the fish. Which, in other words, Jonah sees the fish as God's deliverance. He sees the ocean and the water and the depths of the sea and the seaweed swirling around his neck as that's his death. But the deliverance is when God sends the great fish to swallow Jonah. And it keeps Jonah alive in the depths and in the heart of the sea. And so Jonah doesn't wait till the fish spits him out onto dry land. Jonah doesn't wait till he knows for sure that he's going to survive this ordeal. He knows for sure once the fish swallows him that he's going to survive the ordeal. That God is in control of things in such a way that he is not going to die. And so his prayer is a prayer of salvation, even though he hasn't fully experienced salvation yet. You know what I'm saying? I mean, physically he hasn't gotten on dry land yet. All right, it's not sure yet that. But he prays as if he has. In other words, this is a prayer from the fish. It isn't a prayer from the dry land. And here's what he says in verse 4. He says, "I will again look at your holy temple." Now, he could be referring to the fact that he's going to live and not die, but it could also be referring to something else when he talks about looking at God's holy temple. To go to the temple and worship God was a great privilege. It wasn't just for anybody. It was for the people who were right with God. It was for the people who had offered the sacrifices and who had atoned for their sins and were in a right relationship with God. And it wasn't for people that were, as it were, imperfect. In fact, there were lots of people that couldn't go to temple worship simply because they had physical maladies or because they had leprosy or other problems with them. They were restricted in their worship. So to go to the temple was a sign of God's favor. And Jonah may be saying, he may be looking for the point when he says, "I will once again look on your temple." He may be looking toward the day when his relationship is renewed with God. In other words, it isn't just physical, it's spiritual as well. I've been separated from God because of my sins, but now, because God will forgive me, I will be restored to him. And one day I will be able to enter into his temple and worship him. He's sort of saying what the psalmist in Psalm 51, what David said when he prayed that great prayer of repentance. And he says, "Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me." David is looking towards the renewed joy, the renewed relationship that he's going to have with God once his sins have been cleansed and put behind him. And Jonah seems to be in the same situation. "Once again, I will be able to look at your temple. I will be able to enter into your presence, and I will be able to renew my relationship with you." So he looks forward in hope and in anticipation that God will indeed save him and restore him. In verses 6 to 7, he uses the language of being brought up from the pit. "Again, to the roots of the mountain I sank down to the earth. The earth beneath barred me in forever, but you brought my life up from the pit, O Lord, my God. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, and my prayer rose to your holy temple." Now, this is language, as I referred to this earlier, this is actually language of resurrection. He's talking about going into the pit, or going into Sheol, or going into hell, or entering into death itself, and yet death doesn't hold him. He's talking about being coming back from the dead, even if it doesn't, in the most technical sense, happen. In Jonah's mind, it's the same as being resurrected, as coming back from the dead. Now, where else have you heard this resurrection language from? Remember what Jesus said? Jesus said, "A wicked and adulterous generation ask for a sign. None will be given it except the sign of" who? Sign of Jonah, right? Who was for 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish. So the Son of Man will spend 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And Jesus takes this image of Jonah being dead, as it were, in the heart of the earth, and then 3 days later coming, being spit up on dry land and coming back to life to serve God and to be obedient to him. And Jesus says, that's a picture of what's going to happen to me. I'm going to be dead in the earth for 3 days and three nights, but then I'm going to be alive again to serve God and fulfill his purposes. Jonah speaks the language of resurrection, and he's not resurrected yet. That's my point. The resurrection is coming, but yet he prays as if it has already taken place, as if God has already brought him back to life, already saved him from the pit. And Jesus, by the way, Jesus refers to that twice in the book of Matthew. Now, you know, the New Testament writers are particular about what they record and what they don't record, and to duplicate the same thing twice, which Matthew does, and I believe Mark does as well, it says something, okay? It says that it's an important point. And so Jonah is making this point. God is going to bring me back from the pit. He is going to bring me back to life. So he says, my relationship with God will be restored. I will one day look in your temple. Physically, God will bring me back to life. I will experience this resurrected life. And then in verse 8, he says, those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. But I, with the song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice. Now, Jonah looks to God's grace in verse 8. And it's necessary that he calls it grace, right? Because does Jonah deserve to be saved from the pit? Does Jonah deserve to be redeemed? Does Jonah's life deserve to be? I mean, if you were God, what would you do with Jonah? I mean, if somebody came to you, let's put it this way. Suppose you contracted somebody to work on to remodel your kitchen. And you paid them a big deposit so that they were going to remodel your kitchen. And then after they took this deposit, say it was more money than you could imagine. After they took this deposit, they went and disappeared to the Cancun, you know, or somewhere. And you couldn't find them again. What would you do once you got a hold of this person? Would you say to this person, would you say to this person, no, you still got to come back and do my kitchen? Or would you demand your money and say, look, I don't ever want to talk to you again. I have plenty of other people a lot more reliable than you than working on my kitchen. I mean, if you were God, how would you respond to somebody who basically took your word and went in the opposite direction of what you wanted them to do? What would you do? I mean, I wouldn't have a lot of patience with them, but God sure does. And that's Jonah's point. Jonah's point is, if we trust in other gods, if we trust in idols, or we trust in our own strength, or we trust in, whatever thing we want to make God, and we have lots of gods in our culture, we just don't call them gods, but there are lots of things that we look to save us from our distress and our calamity. I mean, we look to ourselves, we look to government intervention, we look to sports, we look to escapisms, and all sorts of, we look to pleasure, we look to all sorts of things, we look to other people, you know, boyfriends, girlfriends, husbands, wives. We look to all sorts of other things to save us from our distress and our calamity. But Jonah says, look, when we do that, we forfeit the grace that could be ours from the one and true living God. Only God can give us grace. Only God can put up with our rebellion in such a way that despite our wickedness, he still would love us and would still care for us and would still even want to send us back to Nineveh, of all things. So Jonah experiences God's grace in the belly of the fish. The word there is sometimes translated love or mercy. A lot of translations translate it mercy. Or sometimes it's called God's steadfast love. And I like that. idea that God's grace and God's mercy is steadfast. Because, you know, our love and our relationship with God is sort of like a roller coaster. One day it's up, one day it's down. One day we're ready to, you know, to go to the mountains to serve God. The next day we're not. And yet God's love is not like a roller coaster. It is steadfast and steady. Do you realize that He loves you in the depth of your sin as much as He loves you when you were as righteous as you've ever been in life, right? His love for you never changes, regardless of your righteousness or your unrighteousness. His love for you is not a roller coaster that goes up and down depending on how you reacted or how you feel or how He feels that day. His love is constant. It is steady. And He loves you as much today as He has ever loved you or will ever love you. He can't love you any more than He loves you right now because He is steadfast in His love. And so He is quick to forgive Jonah. He's quick to resend him on another mission. And He's quick to extend him grace and mercy. So as a result, you see, Jonah experiences a renewed relationship. He experiences a new life, the resurrected life, and he begins to know the extent of God's grace and God's mercy. Well, then Jonah responds to all of this in verse 9. But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed. I will make good. Salvation comes from the Lord. See what Jonah does? Jonah makes a sacrifice to God. Now, I'm wondering here, what does Jonah have to sacrifice? He's in the belly of a fish. Or you don't take a lot of stuff with you when you're drowning. Okay, so what does he have? He doesn't have any sheep. He doesn't have any animals. He doesn't have, you know, gold or silver. Maybe he has silver in his pocket, but where there's no offering plate to put that in. So where is it? What does he sacrifice in the belly of the fish? What does he give up? And I think he gives up his will. I think he gives up his heart. I think he gives up his rebellion. I think he says to God, God, I'm tired of running from you. I'm going to give myself to you. That's what I think. I think he puts himself on the altar of sacrifice. And he gives God himself. This is what God requires, right? God desires us. He doesn't necessarily desire the animals, the bulls, the goats, the money. He desires us, our lives, our hearts, our wills, our intentions. And so Jonah sacrifices in the belly of the fish. Jonah makes a vow in the belly of the fish. He vows to be, my guess is, he vows to be different. He vows to be obedient to God instead of running away from God. He vows that he's going to go to Nineveh. He vows that he's going to do all that God has called him to do and asked him to do, regardless of whether he likes it or not, regardless of whether it's easy or not. And so he vows to God. Now, the interesting thing about this is exactly what the sailors did, isn't it? We saw this at the end of chapter 1. When the sailors had thrown Jonah into the sea remained calm, and the sailors, it says in verse 16, greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. See, this is what God requires. He requires the sacrifice of ourselves to him, and he requires us to be committed to serving him from here on out. And here's the interesting thing. That happens, okay, not before God saves him, but it happens after God saves him. Now, I know Jonah's not spit out on the ground yet, okay? But Jonah has just prayed this prayer as if God has saved him. And then at the end of the prayer for salvation, he says, now, because God has saved me, I will do this. I will sacrifice myself. I will make these vows. You see, you know the stories. You know, you're in the hospital and you're about to die, and the doctor says you have cancer, and you say, all right, I will now bargain with God. God, if you let me live, I will do that. I will go to church for the rest of my life. And if you let me do this, then I will do this for you. And we try to bargain with God, right? As if, I mean, that's silly if you stop and think about it. God, you really can bargain? You have some chips that God really needs? Oh, yeah. I really need you going to church on Sundays because, boy, the world is going to fall apart if you don't show up on Sunday. You know what I'm saying? Does God really need that? So it's silly to bargain with God, but we think we can. But see, Jonah's not bargaining with God. God has already saved him. God has already extended grace to him. God has already loved him as much as he can possibly love him. Jonah isn't doing this to get God to do something. God has already done something. And he's done an extraordinary thing. He has taken a wicked sinner and he is putting him on the right path. And Jonah says, you know what? as a result of that, I'm going to surrender to God. As a result of what he's already done, I'm going to give myself to him. And so he sacrifices and he makes vows. And he also makes a declaration. And this declaration really sums up the entire chapter, the entire psalm. The end of verse 9, salvation comes from the Lord. Salvation comes from the Lord. This is what the whole theme of the psalm is about. In the depths of the sea, salvation comes from the Lord. In the depths of my rebellion, salvation comes from the Lord. In the depths of my running away from God, salvation comes from the Lord. In the depths of a life that is ebbing away because I am dying from cancer or I'm dying from something, salvation comes from the Lord. In the depths of uncertainty, in the depths of an uncertain future, in the depths of no job, salvation comes from the Lord. When I was doing my little research, because I went back and checked on the guy who jumped into Niagara Falls, just so I didn't want to lie, because I didn't want to lie to you, see? So I was checking on the guy in 2003 who made the plunge, and another story came up, and it's referred to as the Niagara Miracle. In July of 1960, there were two children and a man went out on a boat on the Niagara River, and the boat had motor trouble and quickly capsized. The man who was taking them on this ride went down the falls and died. The 17-year-old daughter or sister to the boy was saved literally 20 feet before going over the falls. There were some bystanders there that got close enough that could actually reach her. But little 6 or 7-year-old Roger Woodward went over the falls with a swimming suit and a life preserver. And it is sometimes called the Niagara Miracle because he was quickly picked up by the Maid of the Mist was coming around, you know, at the bottom of the falls and quickly picked him up, saw him bobbing up and down in the water, and they picked him up in the water. He was fine. It was such an incredible story that many years later, they had a reunion in 1994. And Roger Woodward had this statement to say about his experience. Now, he's going to reference the Indian tribe, the Indian legend of Lilawala. Lilawala was an Indian maid. It's an Indian story that supposedly her spirit is there in the midst of the falls. Right. So, but anyway, this is what he says. Roger Woodward said at that time, "It wasn't the hand of fate. It wasn't the hand of luck. It wasn't the spirit of Lilawala. It was the spirit of the living God that saved my life that day and saved my sister and gave us hope that one day we would come to know him." Isn't that a great statement for a guy that's been saved, for a kid? You know, years later as an adult, what does he say? He's saying, God brought salvation to my life. Because he knew that one day I needed to know him. The Lord is salvation. Whatever situation we face, whether it's floating down the Niagara River about to go over, whether it's rebellion of our sin, whether it's a situation in our lives that is unbearable to us, the Lord is salvation. And God will save us with a purpose. This is what Roger Woodward made, and the purpose is for him to know us and for us to know him, to continue that relationship that he desires out of us. The Lord is salvation. Is the Lord salvation to you this morning in the midst of what you struggle with, in the midst of what you face? Let's pray. Father, forgive us for trusting in idols that cannot save us. We trust in our own willpower. We trust in our own relationships. We trust in our people who are, we think are more powerful than us. We trust in our family. We trust in our wives, our husbands. Before we trust in you, but only in you, can we truly find the definition of grace. So, Father, help us to see you as salvation. Help us to see you as the God who saves our lives from the pit. Not only the pit of the circumstances of this life, but you save us from the very pit of hell itself. And help us to know, Father, as Roger Woodward knew, that you save us with a purpose. and the purpose is intent so that we will know you and worship you. May we be the people who know God. May we be the people who, in the midst of our calamity, worship God. In Jesus' name, amen. We're going to close this morning by singing Mighty to